And so that's kind of become our culture in the last couple of years. We've been really fortunate that we've just had great team after great team after great team, and people who really love being here. And when the guests come in, that's what they feel. They feel like they're a part of something. Like I was saying to you, when I was cleaning up vomit all those years ago, and I decided this is the job that I want to have, that was because I was like 23, and most of that team were like 18 to 21 years old, and nobody earned any money. And all of them had a crazy pride in what they did. They had a crazy pride in working for the Flying Pig and flying that flag. And that was really captivating for me. It was like, there's no reason for you guys to love doing this except for the actual doing it itself. So when you combine that with actually having a budget and being able to pay people and being part of this big nonprofit organization, you can really create a nice atmosphere. And that was my key mission from the moment that I started. And obviously we're still on that road, but we've made a lot of really nice steps, and it's been lovely.
Hello, friends and travelers. Thanks for listening. You are riding along on the Hostel Road Trip podcast. Our mission is to spread awareness of the true hostel experience in the Americas and share stories from the fascinating hosts who create those unique facilities. I'm your host, Jimmy Black, joined alongside co-founder of International Travelers House, Bobby Dyer. Each session, we sit down with hostel operators or travel influencers to hear about their road to success, discuss trending hostel topics, and close with tips for travelers who are seeking to have the ultimate experience when visiting each destination. You can't afford to miss this trip. Now fasten your seatbelts and let's hit the road.
Welcome back to the Hostel Road Trip Podcast. We are very honored to have Alfie McKenzie, one of the newest members of the NAHA, North American Hostel Association board members, newly elected, congratulations. Also joining me, Robert Dyer, also a newly elected board member of NAHA. Just a lot of talent and reputation and status on this episode. And also our first ever Canadian episode. We had always wanted to do the original format of doing the hostel road trip on the road in Canada, but you know, pandemics and things like that obviously have slowed us down. But here we are, first ever Canadian episode. I can't think of anyone else better to be doing it with than the legend we know as Alfie at HI Whistler. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, Bobby. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great to be here, guys.
All right. So, you know, as we always do, you know, we'll obviously jump into a lot more about HI Whistler, HI General. You know, we'll talk a bit about NAHA. But to start off with, you know, we always like to hear about your personal journey of hosteling and how Alfie got into hostel management, you know, and how you found yourself doing this as a career. So, you know, kick it off with that story. How did that happen for you?
Absolutely. Well, I've worked in 9 different hostels in 4 different countries over the last decade, and it wasn't really something like most people I planned to do. I was going to Holland to do my master's degree in philosophy at the time. And I had worked in a hostel briefly before that on a front desk for a couple of months, and they used a PMS that I was pretty good with and pretty familiar with. And I went to stay at this hostel when I moved to Holland, and I was broke. I had about £200 and no clue how I was going to make it work at all. So I went to stay at this hostel, and they were using the same PMS that I used to use. I was running out of money. And I started to kind of knock on the door and say, hey, do you need a volunteer? Because I really needed to volunteer. I had no idea what I was going to do next. So I ended up starting out volunteering for them as in the beginning as a night cleaner. And I would help like some of the guys on the bar and the reception learn how to use the PMS every now and again. Started out cleaning up vomit in a party hostel in Holland. And somewhere between cleaning up vomit and setting up the breakfast every night, some weird part of my brain was like, you know what? I think I just want to do this. If I can somehow make a career out of this and get past the vomit stuff and start like running the bar and running the reception, that would be awesome. So a few months into that gig, I ended up being like the volunteer bar manager. And that was amazing. We didn't have really much budget to make things happen or anything like that, but it was a sweet challenge. We had a lot of really wonderful people, a lot of different wonderful teams. And I really just fell in love with like trying to make crazy parties and events happen in the bar with just like bits of cardboard and paint and shit that was left over from years ago. And we did all of these amazing events and amazing parties. Like we had locals in. It was a small town called Noordwijk on the west coast of Holland. And it was awesome and I fell in love. And I started to think like if I could do this bar manager gig for a while, then that'd be a really sweet experience to try and do it elsewhere in the future. So I did that for a little bit. I moved out and became like a permanent bar manager, member of staff. And then my next move was to Costa Rica. I ran a front desk in Costa Rica for like 4 months, and that was also awesome. And then my plan was to move to Canada. So I went back to Holland and moved to Amsterdam to do like a 6 month gig as an events manager for this huge new hostel called Via that had just opened. And so
Via
Hostels, VIA.
Oh, okay.
So I was doing that. And that was crazy. That was like my first kind of white collar gig as well. Like I remember I was, like I say, my experience was just getting bits of cardboard together and making stuff happen from nothing. And then my boss after a couple of weeks was like, hey, when are you going to do some office time? And I was like, what's office time? So I had a little
tell
office
me about there. This.
I was supposed to do all this event scheduling and stuff. So I had all the time to do that. And they had a budget. They were giving me like a few thousand euros a month to hire musicians and DJs and stuff. And I had always managed to do that with just beer. So that was amazing. And then COVID happened. So the Canada plan got shelved. The events all got shelved. And I ended up working night shift after a bunch of the pandemic for a different company in a different like pod hostel with a Mexican restaurant in the middle of Amsterdam. And one day that company, they owned Dirty Nelly's, which is a big Irish pub slash hostel in Amsterdam, still wasn't open, like quite a way after the pandemic. And I said to the owner, look, I've got all this experience. I've done events, I've done bars, I've done reception. I'm looking for the next step. You don't have to pay me anything extra, but I would love it if you give me the opportunity to go and open Nelly's. And it was a bit of a ballsy move. And the most surprising thing was the guy was like, all right, and just gave me the keys. Told me the budget for
wow.
And yeah, the first few days of doing it, I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing right now. Realized that the hard way. Like pulling
learn it on the run.
Absolutely. Pulling cobwebs off printers and computers. The best bit of that story was the first day the key system wasn't working and we couldn't get it working. We had no idea what to do, but we'd already opened up on all the OTAs and stuff. And we were like, oh no. We had like 5 seconds coming today. So there was this huge bucket full of like old fobs. And we went through every single fob, every single door to see what was working for where. And we found exactly 6 fobs. So one for us. And all of them were manager's fobs though. So they opened the whole hostel. And we just told the guests that it was in that room.
Just
and
your key here.
Exactly. And we just got really lucky that none of them figured it out. And then a couple of days later, we figured the rest out and got open properly. And then finally, I could move to Canada. And when I could move to Canada, I worked in a hotel in the Yukon for a little bit and just missed hostels very quickly. Applied for a gig as a general manager with HI in Vancouver. Went and did that for a year and loved it. And then the Whistler opportunity came up and I came up to Whistler and just fell in love. I was supposed to cover for like 2 months. Yeah. And then I ended up being here ever since. It's been 2 years and we're looking forward to the next few as well. It's been fantastic.
That's awesome. And I love, you know, a lot of times the hostel story or a journey for someone starts in that moment of desperation, like you're talking about, or that situation of desperation of like, wow, like I really need to volunteer here, because if I don't, I'm going to be out on the street in a few nights by my calculations, if my arithmetic is correct, you know. So I love hearing about those types of stories, because it's not often that an industry, you know, has that type of reputation or possibility where it's like, well, is that really at my last options or a point of desperation, so I had to try this, and then by doing so and in trying that, you found what you love doing and what you wanted to do as a career. And I think that's a, you know, such a cool story, but not an uncommon one in the hostel industry. And that's why I always, you know, people are sometimes hesitant with especially work exchange members of like, well, you know, they seem like a nice person, but gosh, they're only doing it because they're desperate or because they need to, or their situation dictates it. And I understand that to an extent, but there are the diamonds in the rough, like yourself, where, you know, hey, you know, they might not know it yet, but this moment of desperation, or that they're, you know, they're trying this out because of that, might lead to something much bigger down the road. So I think that's so cool that that's how you started, and you've weaved your way through so many different hostels and found yourself out there at the HI Whistler, which is such a staple in the HI Canadian operation. But it, just so listeners can understand, because there's always, even at conferences amongst hostel industry people who have been in the industry for years, they still don't understand how HI works, you know, and how the format and the structure is, and independent operations and affiliates and HI USA, HI Canada. So give us just a little bit of a breakdown of like, what is HI Canada and like how does that all work?
Yeah, so the first thing to say is HI Canada is a nonprofit organization. That was the main reason that I'd wanted to work for them for many years, actually. I actually applied for just like a supervisor position at Whistler years ago when I didn't have the visa or anything like that. Because I really loved working in hostels, of course. And after many years in Amsterdam, got a little bit tired of working for people who didn't really care or understand about the hostels that they owned very much, and always having to fight for everything, and feeling like I wanted to do what I did for more of a good cause. And HI's mission essentially is to make sure that hostels still exist and to make sure that travel remains affordable for young people in the area in which they operate. So there's hundreds
That's
of
cool.
HI organizations. They go under slightly different names. In Holland, it's Stay OK. In the UK and other countries, it's YHA. Obviously, you have HI USA as well. And we're all part of the same network. We have the same quality assurance program as well, which is international. But we are also all our own independent nonprofit organizations. So with the hostels that I've worked for in HI, I started out at Jericho Beach Hostel in Vancouver, which has just turned 52 years old. It's an army barracks, which was originally occupied by, originally it was the army, and then it was a nunnery briefly, I believe. And then it was occupied by hippies for a really long time. And there was a legendary riot. You can Google the Battle of Jericho. There was a riot in 1969, which erupted when the police tried to evict these hippies during the Summer of Love from Jericho Beach. And if you go and stay there now, you'll be quite amazed how the vibe is still pretty much exactly the same as it would have been back in 69. And the beautiful thing of working in a place like that, or working here in HI Whistler, is just that, like I say, you're doing it for essentially a good cause. We all have this shared value of trying to make sure that places can remain affordable. Obviously, you have to compete with the market that you're in, but we compete in a way where we try so hard to be the bottom line and to make sure that people, young people, can come and travel to a place like Whistler, which is not cheap, which is often super expensive, especially for accommodation. And we look after them and we house them. And not only that, but we create a community, we create a vibe, and that takes everybody on board. It's the management, it's the staff, and it's the guests and the local community. And we make partnerships with people in the local area, all over Canada, If you stay at HI Whistler, you'll get discounts with HI Whistler, with Whistler businesses that are in the local area. And just exactly the same if you're in Vancouver, or if you're going to our new property in Halifax, or if you're going to the Banff location, you get the hostel, you get the cheap accommodation, you get the community, and you also get a lot of really decent discounts in the local area and around Canada in general. So that's why I really wanted to work for HI and why I love them as an organization. The thing that really fascinates me a lot of the time is people don't know that we're a nonprofit organization. And if you don't know that, then it's very normal to kind of assume that it's a big corporate brand. And so that's a really big part of my day to day in the job, is trying to make sure, especially in the local community, that people understand that we are a nonprofit and that we do it for a really solid reason. I was talking to a really lovely lady called Jackie, who runs the Whistler Community Services Society, a couple of weeks ago. So we just got a new liquor license for our patio cafe. And it's pretty cool. And that's really nice. I'm really glad that that's on offer. And I said, yeah, well, you know, we're a nonprofit, and it's really important to us that we become a community space. It's obviously a big part of it is making sure that we remain affordable, and that we hit our targets year on year so that we can thrive and survive. But a big part of it as well is just there was nothing like that in the area, exactly where our hostel is, for the community. And she was like, I never knew that you were a nonprofit organization. And then she runs the biggest community services organization in town. So yeah, that's our mission. And we need to do more for sure to try and fly that flag.
Absolutely. Bob, you had something to add there?
Yeah, with you said you worked at 9 hostels before you landed there. What is something that you felt like was amazing at the hostels that you wanted to bring? Like, what you got a lot of experience, probably worked at good hostels, bad hostels. What did you see as like the magic that was like, this is what it takes to be a great hostel, and I'm going to take that, put that in my pocket, and set it up in Whistler?
Yeah, well, the first thing when I came to Whistler, it was a completely different proposition from any of the hostel that I'd worked at. Usually I come into a hostel and the issues are kind of organizational, structural, training, PMS, operational kind of concerns. And the community and the vibe and all that kind of stuff is kind of already ticking. When I came to Whistler, I got really, really, really lucky, especially because it was my first proper general management gig, just completely by myself up here running it. And the gentleman that I inherited the job from had done a fantastic job in terms of running it as a really sustainable, successful business. So there was a lot to learn from in that, but I could see straight away that there was a lot of room for improvement in terms of just our atmosphere and our community output. So the first thing, honestly, was the liquor license. It seemed like low-hanging fruit to me that we had this really tiny cafe, which had a really tiny liquor license. We could legally serve 12 people in this very tiny space right in front of the service area, and which is basically useless, because when you have a hostel of over 100 people in the winter and you can only serve 12 of them a beer, nobody's going to do it. You can maybe serve one group, and then you get this weird situation where, you know, the 13th person walks into the bar and you go, oh, hey, buddy, nope, sorry, I need you to walk back over that line, because there's already 12 beers in play right here. So that was the first thing. And that was a huge education, working with, you know, the whole bureaucracy of the liquor planning sort of system here in BC and Canada. It took a very long time. I had to get architects to bring up plans. And this building, HI Whistler, was built for the Winter Olympics in 2010. And it was part of the athletes' housing. So I had to ring up the original architect that had built it for the Olympic Committee to get into this tiny job of just redrawing the same thing that he drew 14 years ago, and just sign off on it again and say, yes, you can have a patio here, because we already did have a patio. It just wasn't licensed. And then I also got really lucky, and also a little bit of nice karma. There's a gentleman who lives in the same neighborhood as me, and I have a parking space that I don't use at the moment because I don't have a car. And he was just a nice guy who lived close to me, and he didn't have a parking space, but he did have a car. I offered him my parking space, and about 6 months later, when I finally sent off the liquor application to the local municipality, I got a call straight away, like, "Is that Alfie that lives in the Rise?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Hey, it's your boy." So the guy that I had sorted out with the parking space was actually the guy who was overseeing our liquor planning application. So that was amazing. And yeah,
that's it came through
pretty quickly. And then we introduced like a draft beer system. We completely renovated the patio. And, you know, we've been putting on all kinds of new events over the last year or so. And really, more than that, it's about the recruitment culture for me. When I came in, my managers were very diligent and efficient at getting a team together at the right time and getting people who are very skilled and experienced. And I kind of changed the tack a little bit when I came in and said that, you know, experience and skill is really not as important as getting people who want to work in a hostel. So every single interview that we do, the first question, why do you want to work for us? That's a deal breaker. And you get a lot of people who say, well, you know, I want to live in Whistler and ski for the season. And your job came up. And then it's like, okay, well, now you're going to have a really good interview from here to get
to win it back.
Yeah, exactly. But if you get somebody who has no idea what they're doing, maybe they're 19, they've never worked a job before in their lives, but they're like, I stayed with you guys this summer and I loved it. And I've been around a few hostels in Europe or whatever. And I want to like be a part of that kind of community and seeing it's like done. Like you can train and you can develop people when they have that willingness.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's kind of become our culture in the last couple of years. And we've been really fortunate that we've just had great team after great team after great team. And people who really love being here. And when the guests come in, that's what they feel. They feel like they're a part of something. Like I was saying to you, when I was cleaning up vomit all those years ago, and I decided this is the job that I want to have, that was because I was like 23, and most of that team were like 18 to 21 years old, and nobody earned any money. And all of them had a crazy pride in what they did. They had a crazy pride in working for the Flying Pig and flying that flag.
And that
was really captivating for me. It was like, there's no reason for you guys to love doing this except for the actual doing it itself. So when you combine that with actually having a budget and being able to pay people and being part of this big nonprofit organization, you can really create a nice atmosphere. And that was my key mission from the moment that I started. And obviously we're still on that road, but we've made a lot of really nice steps, and it's been lovely.
Wow. No, that's great. And I love the, you know, I often use I switch it up a bit. It's a classic old saying, if you walk up to three guys and you ask the first one, what are you doing? He says, I'm laying bricks. You ask the second guy, what are you doing? I'm building a wall. You ask the third guy, what are you doing? I'm building a church. They're all doing the same thing, but they're all looking at it in a very different way. I've always used the shitter for hostels in that way of like, if you have one of those days and you're cleaning a bunch of shitters or you're flipping a bunch of bunk beds, like I never looked at it as I'm cleaning the shitter or flipping the bunk bed. I'm like, oh man, I'm running the best hostel in the city. That's what I'm doing. You know, I don't know. I'm not cleaning shitters. So it's how you look at it. And then if you get people that can have that same mindset and you build a team like that, then that really sets that special sauce in the culture.
Yeah, and, let's clean this shit together. Exactly.
Yeah, it is really profound, and you put it in a good way of like the Flying Pig's a great example of like you're looking at all these kids that are working their asses off, taking it super seriously, having a very high pride and value in their work, and they're not getting paid. And I've always found that very fascinating. To, you know, money a lot of times can throw a wrench in that type of culture, in that type of vibe. And it's some people look at it and they're like, I don't know what the fuck's going on, but the person who is looking at it in that way of like, I'm not laying bricks, I'm building a church, you know, that type of thing, that is very contagious, and it draws the right type of people in. It also keeps the wrong type of people out too. I think that's great that you've
you've built that up there, you know, HI Whistler. Now, one thing that I was really interested in when we were hanging out at the conference and just talking about, you know, your experience at HI, and you've touched on a little bit here with budgets, but it does seem like, you know, and but correct me if I'm wrong, I always felt like it would be a very corporate structure, like you said, and like a lot of policies, procedures, but it seems like they pretty much just give you a budget and let you run with it and give you a lot of creative freedom and a lot of operational freedom. Would you say that that's true?
Yeah, I'd say that's really accurate. It's a little bit of a mixture of the two. We do have a really strong, solid upper management who are all very skilled and very experienced, A, in what they do, whether it's HR or marketing or membership strategy. But also, all of them have their own traveling stories and experiences, and are all in it for the right reason. So there's times where we might disagree with each other on strategy, sometimes a lot of times. But at the end of the day, it's not like when you're disagreeing with your boss and trying to show him, like, we need more money for this thing because it's going to make it better. It's you're disagreeing with each other because you both have pretty much the same vision and the same goals. And so when you hash it out, you come up with a plan that's almost always a compromise between everybody's vision. And so you finish your work day and there's not that kind of stress, or you don't feel like you're not being seen or not being valued, because you know that everybody's coming from a good place. It's not like anybody's trying to, you know, pocket the money somewhere. We're all just earning a salary and doing the best that we can do. But when it comes to actually running the hostel, yeah, it's been quite, especially in the early days, it was quite a surprise to me how much freedom we do get as general managers to basically be entrepreneurs in our local area. We have check-ins and we make sure that we keep the senior management team up to date with everything that we're doing, but we go to them with the vision that we want to create. The patio is a fantastic example, because I can see in the past other jobs that I've worked at, it's quite a big project and it's quite a crazy amount of vision that we put into it, just the management team here at the hostel. We wanted to have a very specific kind of patio that looked a certain way, that felt a certain way. We wanted to get local beer in from the brewery. We needed to introduce a draft system. And all of that was a lot of money, a lot of time, and a lot of work. And generally, the whole time, my bosses were just like, okay, tell me more. And how is that going to work? And how is this going to be successful? And if I can show them that strategy and that vision, A, we can get it done. And B, they can lend their expertise and experience to telling me how to do it better. Like Rianne, that you met at the conference as well.
I loved her. Yeah.
We all love Rianne, who was running both of the Vancouver hostels, still is. She has a wealth of experience in F&B and project management in general. So like just that, I can tap into that. We were coming up with this project and I said to my bosses, I really want Rianne to be a part of this, because as much as I know what I want to do, I know that having somebody with that amount of experience to come in and tell me, okay, I see what you want to do. Here's why you don't want to do it this way. Or even just tiny things of like, your oven should be here so that your thing over here will work better and your staff can move around more easily and all that kind of stuff. So it works out really well, where you really get the freedom to do things how you want to do things. But you also, if you just take a little bit of a humble pill, you can also listen to a wealth of experience and expertise from everybody else who have different skill sets, different levels of experience, but the same goal and the same vision. So it works really well.
Outstanding. Bob Dyer, something to add to that?
How long did it take the construction process?
So the patio was always there. That was the crazy thing, that it wasn't kind of done way back when. And what we changed was mostly the furniture. So we had literally the same furniture from the Olympics. We got rid of all of that. We put in some really nice wooden picnic tables. I have quite a close connection with the local brewery that's down the road, mostly because I like to go to the local brewery that's down the road. And so we were able to get a kind of exclusivity contract with them and their beer. That also meant that we got like their umbrellas, we got their glasses, their pitchers, all that kind of stuff. And we love those guys. So we're really happy to have that partnership and kind of sell their local product to people who come through. We got couches out of the front. We had these really old but really good heaters that, again, were from the Olympics, but just hadn't worked for a really long time. So we got contractors in to look at that, and they got fixed and they're working, and they're like insanely hot, which is going to be interesting in winter to see how far they go. So it wasn't so much of a construction project as more of a renovation. And the draft system, which was really challenging but really fun to figure out, because like I've worked on a bar for a long time but never like installed one. We just got like a kind of big kegerator that goes at the end of the cafe bar. We got rid of some old stuff to make space for it, and set it up, and it took about a full 8 hours because my maintenance guy was on vacation, and my cafe manager was on his day off. And we had the beer, we had the system, and I was like, I want to have a beer after work.
Man, you're thirsty.
Yeah, exactly. So I spent 8 hours trying to get it to work and kept coming into all kinds of little problems because I'd never done that before. And kept calling Oog, who's my friend, who's the bar manager at the brewery, and just like, he's working, trying to run a full shift at the brewery. And I'm like, Oog, okay, the beer's coming out, but it's not fizzy or whatever, all little tiny problems. And and then I nearly gave up, and I was like, we were so close, but nothing was happening. And I was like, I'm sure it's just a little problem. I'm just going to leave it for today, go to the lake, chill out with my friends. And then I went to the bus stop and I was like, no. And I went back and carried on working on it, just straightened everything out a little bit, literally like all the pipes and stuff. And then the beer started flowing, and I've never cheered that much in my entire life. Poured nice. This full pitcher. There's a picture of me just like tears coming out of my eyes with this pitcher of beer. That was a 2 year dream of getting beer in that cafe on draft. And that was the final step.
That's a unique feeling. James and I had a bar, and like when you're, it's a beautiful feeling, a dangerous feeling when you start pouring yourself your own beers from your own tap. Yeah. It feels like heaven, you know, drinking those beers.
Yeah, what for sure.
Looking back, like on the process of doing construction, there's a lot of hostels want to put in bars or enhance their bars. What is something you can reflect on and kind of learn from that process that you'd maybe do different or glad you did the certain way?
I would say the main thing is I probably could have and should have leaned on my local business friends earlier. I was still, especially at the beginning, I was really new to town, so I didn't really have as many connections yet. And I was kind of begging my boss to make me the licensee so that I could just do everything myself. And that took a while, but eventually that happened. And then, when I became the licensee, it was just like, well, there you go. And I realized that I had to do so much research, and I was going through all the steps. And thinking, if I just go through all the steps, like, and figure out exactly what I've got to do each step of the way, it'll be fine. But there's a bunch of unknown unknowns that come along, which only later, talking to like the guys at the brewery, because they actually got a new patio recently as well. They're like, oh, you know, we could have told you that you would have had a problem with that. And a lot of giggling at like when I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure we're gonna get this license now. I've applied for it. It'll probably take a couple of weeks. And they're like, But also just like keep trucking. That's the main thing. If there are unknown unknowns, just keep pushing the envelope, and those unknown unknowns will slowly become at least known unknowns. And
he's like Don Rumsfeld.
I am not a reptile.
But two things that really want to applaud. Like, I think it's awesome that HI creates that environment where you know they're letting you run with it, but then there's that element of the momentum is contagious, and that positive attitude is contagious when you surround yourself with people that are wanting to see you succeed and giving you the opportunity to succeed. And I think that's awesome that they've created that type of environment where it's very easy for people to like, oh, I tried to do that and turn that patio into something years ago and it didn't work. So you can't do it either. Yeah. You know, you can get a lot of that in businesses and corporate structure. And one thing I've always noticed is the team, you can, you know, as we've grown in size at ITHA, when I see the team working together to push each other, like, hey, you know, that's a great idea. And what if you tried this? And then the other person's like, oh my God, that's an awesome, you know, amendment to that idea or a little change or deviation. And now that just brought this idea to mind. And then someone else pitches in, then you should try this. And now that collective, that collaborative idea, like you said, because everyone's going for the same goal if you've got a good culture like that, right? It, on the flip side, you can really tell that a place isn't doing good when someone comes up with a really cool idea and people are pissed off about it. That's bad. Absolutely. That's bad news bears. Whenever I see that, I'm like, oh boy, we got to all sit on the magic carpet and talk about our feelings here for a little bit. Because,
yeah,
you know, we should be excited that our teammate or our coworker or our peer just came up with a bangbusters idea. And how could we maybe even make that better? And then is that person, this is also super important. And as you said, asking for help, using your network, using other people's experiences, because good people like to see other people do good in business. Successful people like to see other people do successful, you know, the really good business people. And they're out there, and surround yourself with those type of people and then ask and listen. And you'll get so much advice that can save you time and pain yourself of learning from their mistakes. But, you know, so many people, especially when they're on a run with a good idea, they get selfish with the idea. And they don't, you know, this is my idea, it's my patio. But, you know, screw you with that idea about putting the draft over there. In the back of your head, you're like, shit, that's a really good idea.
Yeah,
you know, but if you're willing to take that learning curve, and, you know, for me, years ago when that happened, that was such a profound thing for me of like, more so going into the room of like, hey, I had this idea last night. What is everyone thinking? Does anyone have anything to add to that could make it better? And then just watching that process run, that's a beautiful thing. And that's how you get those big projects done, because you need the collective, you need the effort. And in closing on that, when you hit those bumps in the road, or, you know, this is another thing I didn't think of, and there was so much more to it than I, you know, that's when you've got to almost put the pedal to the metal a little bit more, you know, like, oh, you know, so many people just stop. Well, it was a great idea, but they said I had to move the window 16 inches. I'm out, you know. So I think that's great that, you know, and you could do a case study on that for people of like, here's the idea. Here's what we had to go through. Here's how long it took. But look at this beautiful end. And doesn't the beer taste so much better? You know, when you go through those battles.
That's the thing. And it comes back to the same thing of having that pride in what you do. And if you can have that filter down from the top all the way to the bottom, and have that humility, which kind of has to come from the manager or the management or the structure a lot of the time as well.
Top down, yeah.
In order to allow that culture to ride. But it's a very simple thing to implement. And then you can kind of just let the ball run. Like, for sure, if I disagree with my management team, my departmental managers here at HI Whistler, I sort of reserve the right to veto decisions every now and again. But in 2 years of doing this, I never have. Like, we always discuss it and we always come up with an idea together. And if one of my guys comes up with a better idea than me, or comes up with something that's really going to work, like, I just get excited.
Excited, yes.
Yeah, because as well, I want to see them do well, and I want to see them develop and grow. It's also a really big part of HI in general, is creating those success stories and identifying young, talented people who maybe don't have the experience, but you can see that with a bit of guidance, they will do something amazing with that experience once you give it to them. So the patio has been incredible just as a crucible of all of that stuff, because it took me, it took my F&B manager, Harry, it took my maintenance manager, Ray, And it took a lot of work, especially in the kind of months when we were preparing to open. We all did way too many hours trying to get that thing done. And in the end, when we did get it done, we could sit on our patio that we envisioned and created and made happen together. And that we all developed as people and as professionals through doing that project as well.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
It's done, and we're better, and this place is better. And it's a lovely thing. Really, really cool.
Yeah. And when you come out the other side, you're so much better of an operator for it, you know, because you've gone through that process, the highs, the lows, two steps forward, one step back. You know, so I think that's just a, you know, such a cool story that, you know, you should be proud of. But don't be shy to pat yourself on the back and take credit for it while you still have control. You know, maybe a nice, like, King Henry VIII type portrait of Alfie, a nice bust, you know, something simple that
just
will be
right
there forever.
Over my dad.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, who's that right behind the bar? Oh, I'm Alfie.
Yeah. I try every now and again.
Yeah. Now, all right. So that's awesome. And I can't wait to try out this patio and H.I. Whistler. And, you know, and before. Tell us a bit about H.I. Whistler before I want to ask a little bit about the Naha. Like, what is Whistler like? Is it, you know, you've got your seasons are dramatically changing. Like, what do you do throughout the seasons? It's obviously a big ski and snowboarding town, which everyone knows. So, but what do you do in the summer?
In the summer, basically the mountain is the whole thing. And it's actually two mountains in Whistler. We have Blackcomb Mountain and Whistler Mountain. And they are both unbelievably huge and vast. So the resort side of the mountain is huge. Like, for example, my F&B manager, Harry, he's lived here nearly 4 years, and he's still not done, like, all of the runs in the resorts. And
wow!
I've got quite a few to go because it's vast. And that's just kind of the resort front-facing side of the mountain. Then you have the backcountry, and when you do your avalanche training and all that kind of stuff, you just have this incredible, never-ending world to go and explore. And then a bunch of other mountains in the area, little-known trails and lakes that are in volcanoes and just all kinds of stuff that you can go and do. It's really quite spectacular as an activity destination. And then in the summer, it becomes a biking metropolis. And for exactly the same reasons. So they will close one of the mountains a little bit longer than the other one. One of the mountains will open up right at the beginning of summer, usually around May time. And then everyone can go mountain biking. And it's a lot of the same runs, the same terrain as you would have been skiing on or snowboarding on. So it's kind of a really funny thing. You go up the lift in the middle of December and everything's absolutely covered in snow. It's a power day, everyone's skiing and snowboarding. And then you go up the same lift 6 months later and everyone's biking and it's all green and brown and still beautiful, but completely different proposition. Both of the mountains eventually open and you can mountain bike all summer on both of the mountains. And then they close and then they open again in the winter for the skiing and the snowboarding. And outside of that, like I say, there's so many trails and mountains just in the area. Just here at the hostel, we're a little bit outside of the village, but our back of the hostel looks out onto Mount Sprout, which is a really beautiful mountain. And if you don't live in this area, it's one that a lot of people don't know about, but you can hike up there. A lot of people don't. So you're usually by yourself when you get up there. It's a pretty hefty hike, not super long, but pretty steep. And then you get up there and there's two lakes that are just on the top of this freaking mountain. It's like a natural infinity pool. It's awesome. And just all kinds of stuff like that I've only been here 2 years, so I'm still discovering stuff all of the time, and the list of things that I want to go and do and explore just gets longer and longer. I was always a beach bum and a city boy, and I love being a fish out of water here because the fun just never stops. I'm constantly challenging myself to do something that I've never done before. I had never snowboarded before I came to Whistler. I had never done like hikes that are that huge and vast before I came to Whistler. I never camped in the winter before I came to Whistler or made a fire in the middle of the snow, all these kinds of things. And I just fall in love every time because my comfort zone has always been to be outside of my comfort zone. And if I'm not regularly, I get freaked out and I need to move. So Whistler is really the first place in a while where I can see myself being here for a hot minute, because there's just, it's never ending, the stuff to explore and to achieve on a personal level. So it's really a year round town. We have the fall season is a little bit more challenging because it's a town full of adrenaline junkies, right? So everyone's been mountain biking all summer and doing all this kind of crazy shit and partying and whatever. And then the temperature drops a little bit, but it doesn't drop quite enough. And the snow's coming for like 6 to 8 weeks. And everyone's like, they can't go on the mountain anymore because everyone's got to do all the work. So people get itchy. And that's the only weird time in Whistler where you have to get a little bit inventive and creative. But like for me, we're less than 2 hours drive away from Vancouver. So you can always go and party and do a couple of amazing gigs and events and all that kind of stuff down in the city as well, or still go on all of the hikes that are available in the local area. And then it's just 6 to 8 weeks, and then the mountain opens again for snowboarding, and then it's cowabunga for the whole winter season.
Wow. We have a mountain. We operate in a mountain town in Big Bear, so we're familiar with how that works.
Beautiful hostel.
Distinct seasons. I was going to say, do you guys cater to a lot of groups there, or
yeah,
a lot of group business and focus on getting more groups, or how do you focus on filling your occupancy, kind of being in a more, remote, not a major, you're in a major mountain town, but, still a destination.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's really a sweet spot for the amount of group business that you want to have. Like when I first came into Whistler, we were in the middle of just a gut-bustingly amazing snow season. It was super busy. Probably if you were being really cold and hard from a business perspective, you wouldn't have needed any group business for that whole season, because you could have just sold every bed individually one by one. But it really, really, really helps as a forecasting tool, I find, to make sure that you have a certain amount of group business. You have a certain amount of business on the books where you can look at December 6 months in advance and go, okay, well, we know we're at least making this bottom line of revenue because we have these groups coming in. And then how much do we want to sell bed by bed? I had like two extremes. My first winter season was crazy busy like that. And I kind of thought maybe we can pull back on some of the group business that we did, and maybe give less rooms to some of like our long-term contracts and all that kind of stuff, in order to like have an even better season next year. And so I did in some ways. And it was a really hard lesson, because then the snow just didn't come. And those groups were very happy that they had not taken up more rooms and more beds from us, because nobody wanted to come at certain parts of the season because there's no snow. It's still an amazing place to come. You can always ski and snowboard through the winter. But like, especially Christmas, for example, we had no snow on Christmas. So why are you going to go and stay in this magical winter resort town when there's no snow? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And we did manage to sell out for Christmas, but we had to get really inventive and really creative. And that was a huge lesson for me, in terms of pricing strategy. That really opened my eyes to trying to be a lot more proactive. And in general, try and shift the balance to being way more proactive and way less reactive in general. If you're proactive in a general sense, then when it does come to your high season, you don't really need to be reactive, because you have the right amount of beds for the right amount of people, and then you can sell them for the right price and hit all the targets that you want to hit, for, in our case, for the good of the network. But yeah, so that's been a huge education for me in my first 2 years running this business. And this year, for example, even though we're forecasting, it's looking like, touch wood, it could be a really good snow season. I'm definitely making sure that we have a decent amount of group business on the books.
That's nice.
And also maintaining those relationships with people who run those groups. And they remember that you gave them a sweet deal this year and that year and whatever. And so you can work together, because usually when you're having a crappy season, they're having a crappy season too. And you can knock heads together and try and figure out a way to drum up some business for each other. So yeah, it's been really important for us.
That's great. Yeah, it's amazing with this. When it snows, it fills up. I love when you get the phone call and they're like, is it going to be snowing on December 13th? And you're It's brilliant. Do you have to do the group business, or does HI corporate, or the people, the sales team, take care of all the group business?
I take over most of the group business. We have larger contracts that are kind of network round, like travel trade stuff, that is mostly out of my hands, but I at least get to negotiate the rate that they're going to get at the start of the budget year. So if our group's manager says he wants to sell them beds for $40 a piece, I can push back and be like, okay, well, I understand why you want to do that. Like, they're a great group and we want to keep them on board, but we probably need to go a little bit higher than that because of little tiny things that I maybe understand a little bit more just from being on the ground in this town in particular. And it's always a nice conversation, and we always end up coming up with something that we both think is the right thing. But when it comes to individual groups, I personally take over all of those, because a lot of the time it's just too important to let go. It's too important to kind of to get the price too low or too high at any time, especially when it's like 6 months out and you're looking at the winter. And if it's a group that they're just coming to Whistler, they're not interested in other parts of Canada, then I really need to sell our product. And I know specifically the target that I'm trying to hit and how far away I am from that because of this project and that project and maintenance costs and whatever. So individual groups I do handle.
That's nice. Yeah, with the big bear groups, when we have those repeat groups, I'm always thinking to myself, how do I get this guy to put down half payment for next year, same week, you know, before he leaves right now, so you can keep them locked in and build around them. But as we're running out of time here now, I do want to touch base and again congratulate you on your recent NAHA board member association approval. I once again failed my drug test, and I'll have to wait till next year. Either that or Joe Gill blackballed me again. I don't know. It's open for debate. But what is your board member seat? What is your? Give us a little bit of details about this. Like, what department were you put ahead of? Tell us about NAHA.
I guess that's all to be sort of detailed in the coming weeks. We're having our first board meeting this month, 12th of September.
Oh, okay.
And we are, you know, we're coming to the board meeting with our own idea of what we would like to be really involved in. Personally, just I want to contribute as much as I possibly can with my experience, and out of the kind of options for me, I think my experience would be lent more to the conference side of things, just having been an events organizer and an events planner in the past. But I'm willing to contribute in any way possible. And it's really exciting that it's just such a young organization. I went to that conference not really knowing what to expect at all, and I was just super flabbergasted and impressed by the appetite of everyone in the room to collaborate, to work together, and the recognition of pretty much to a man, everybody I met, that what works for one person is going to work for us all, and that we do have this, it's a unique industry where we really have a hugely shared interest. And seeing the appetite from everyone, and also seeing that like there was no specific agenda of like what it's going to be. It was really a case of trying to figure out from the owners and the managers, what do you want it to be? What would be a good association for everybody, and what would be good for the network in general? There was a lot of input on that, and I'm excited to see what that resulted in, and contribute to kind of defining the direction going forward as a board.
Yeah, you know, that is so true. And hat off to Jim Kennan and the Punk and Brew guys, and Jay and Frankie for really just hitting it out of the park. And I think that they did it in the perfect way of that kind of reverse engineering it by, you know, what do you want it to be? What are you looking for? And being very inclusive with everyone. And that gravitated everyone. And I think that they separated themselves from some other attempts at putting together this group. And I love how they included Canada and Mexico, and really excited about the conference being down in Mexico in this coming April. So all you listeners out there, make sure you stay tuned for when that exact location and dates in Mexico will be, but I'm sure it'll just be another amazing time. And congratulations to you on the board member assignment. I'm sure you called your mother right away to let her know. And, you know,
I sent her a message.
I hope that you get the committee assignment that you're looking for. And I know that you'll do a great job and Bob will do a great job as well, and keep on rocking out that association, because I think it's got amazing momentum.
Yeah, it's super exciting. And obviously seeing that Bobby was on the team as well was really cool. And I'm really looking forward to it, man. Even if I don't get the specific committee role that I'm looking for, I'd still will be excited to contribute to any angle of it going forward. When I was sat in that room, like going back to those days when I was cleaning up the vomit and I was a volunteer night shift like in a decade ago, I was sat there thinking like, this is just exactly where I need to be right now. And everything I did up until this point got me here. And I'm so grateful to be in this room, collaborating with these people to try and figure out how we can make a robust, really exciting, really awesome hostel industry for business owners and for the industry, but also, of course, for the travelers and for the backpackers that are coming through, and to create this really exciting proposition of a hosteling network in North America, which people in Europe, like from my own experience, we're really ignorant towards hostels in America. Like I stayed at your guys' properties in Southern California. I stayed at the Green Tortoise with those guys in Seattle, and obviously stayed at the Bunk and Brew and Jim's Portland hostel in Oregon. And it was just such an eye-opener this last year, going towards those hostels and being like, holy shit, these are real hostels, like really, really real hostels with a real vibe, real community, real spirit. And I feel like I'm in the perfect place, and I'm going to be here on this continent for as long as I can do good work for this
whole thing. There you go. Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah, Alfie. Love it. Well, hey, thanks so much for joining us, and so much exciting stuff for you, you know, with your location and the improvements and the Naha board, and looking forward to seeing you in April. And you know that you always have a standing invitation to our company manager retreat at the Joshua Tree Music Festival every May in October. You know, you're always welcome to come get weird with us in the desert.
Beautiful.
All right, man. Thanks so much. God bless.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.